Well, we talked last time, the session was called A Return to Harmony. I'm calling this one A Return to Harmony 2. Simple enough. But I thought it might be good to take into regard Paul's series that he's been working on all month, and for the coming book that he's working on. I went to Paul and I asked what might be some conversation points that we could throw around a little bit, and he mentioned two things, and one, we're just to converse and to talk a little bit about how penning the pilgrimage, language meets life, and life meets language, that interchange between the two. And the second thing was maybe the commonalities, the contrast, the relationship between description and interpretation in writing. What begins, what ends, what's in between. And I thought I'd go ahead and sing you a song first. That's kind of just, into my ears, a descriptive song in the sense that it kind of paints a scene. And then I'd like to hear your thoughts afterwards, whether it's descriptive or interpretive, or it's called Singing in Your Cage.
You were born on branches green, resting in the shade. Your mama's weight till your flying day. But yellow wings are precious things in a city far away. Now you're up for sailing, gilded wire, singing in your cage. Johnson needs a friend to sit beside a bed. Wake her up at break of day, talk of the news she's read. Sit by the fire, she'll stroke your wings, old photos fill the page. Now it's time for bed and back you go, singing in your cage. Now she's seen a steam train come and go, the freeway split the glade. Giant steps upon the moon are just a backyard away. The century's lost its melody, or is it just my age? Soothe my nerves and calm my fears, singing in your cage. Sing a song of happiness, sing the song for tears. Sing it for tomorrow, sing for yesterday. The night is long, but love is strong. Keep singing. Keep singing. Singing in your cage. Ooh, do, 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 oh, 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 oh. broken, there she was, fire cold and gray. Neither than the mystery book, I turned the final page. The window's thrown wide open, wings are free to fly. But she sits inside a gilded cage, singing a lullaby. Sing a song of happiness, sing a song for tears. Any way the tune may go, it's music to my ears. Sing it for tomorrow, sing for yesterday. The night is long, but love is strong.
So it's a story about a bird. I guess you gathered that by the end. A story about a bird, but not just a story about a bird, but a story about a woman. A bird who grows up in the wild and is sold to the markets. And Edith Johnson buys the bird and brings her home. Can I just hear from anybody who would like to contribute? It's descriptive. Is it interpretive? What does it mean to you? How does it hit you? Where did those two descriptions, interpretations meet? This song occurred to me, I'll add a little charcoal to the thoughts and if it helps. This song occurred to me in Key West, and it was really given through a Rumi poem, as I read this Rumi poem about his, he talks a lot about singing and dancing through life, sing through your pain, sing through your sorrows. And he said, sing in your cages, you know, sing in your, the things that that bind you and leave you in bondage. It's a story about a bird in captivity, and it's also a story of a bird who gives a woman, well, it's also a story of a woman in captivity to me as well. And how those two lives meet. That's basically the story. But if you listen to the lyric line go down, it's pretty much Edith Johnson needs a friend to sit beside her bed. It tells of a happening of movement in lives without saying. An old woman was feeling sick in her room. She needed friendship and looked for companionship in her old age. It somehow finagles its way to the interpretation through some of the description. Do you think those meet in all songs and in all works? Or I guess if it's a biological description, I guess it could be simply a technical manual of some kind, but do you think those meet?
You're asking if they meet in all songs?
I don't know about all songs, but do you think they... Can you describe their relationship? Do you think one can exist without the other? Are they always together? Can they kind of exist on their own planes?
Yes and yes.
Can you... Okay, and that could be... And do you know of songs or works that exist on that way? I mean, like, say, just as a description. I was thinking, you know, one that just came to mind, you know. Red River Valley. Well, I mean, that's, I don't know that whole song, but that's kind of a descriptive song.
Yeah, it tells a story.
What happens in that story? Do you know the rest of the... Do you know that song, Rolf?
I don't know the lyrics.
Yeah.
Well, Peter, in the song you just sang, I feel like the is able to enter into the interpretation so much more because of the description. Mm. So you were born in the trees and that great description of the outdoors. And I thought of the line, yellow breasts are precious, which is more specific and descriptive than just interpretive.
Yeah.
It means all life is precious on a level. Mm. There's some ambiguity there about is it the bird or the woman, at least in one hearing.
Yeah.
But the color pulls you in a different way, I think.
There's something about that specificity that pulls you into some of the meaning. I wrestled with this when Paul originally brought this up because I don't know, I have trouble separating those. To me, music from the time I heard Please Please Me or Ask Me Why or Cliff Richards in the Shadow or Elvis, it moved me in a certain way. So, and poetry moves me in a certain way. So, one always seemed to affect and lead to the other. In one way or another, that always hit me that way. But they definitely could precede or follow another. There wasn't necessarily a certain order that happened, but they have a powerful relationship together.
I think there's some very powerful songs that are just simply descriptive. And in some ways, that stark description is what makes them so powerful.
I mean,
I think of a song, Soldier's Things, which is a Tom Waits song he wrote in the 80s, I assume about a soldier in Southeast Asia, and it's basically just a list of the things that are for sale at this person's, you know, he had been killed in battle, and it's this list of a young man's things, and there's no, that's simply what it is, this list, it's just,
that's powerful.
Yeah, it's just really powerful.
Why is it so powerful, though, that, you know, how can just a list of things do that to us?
Well, because it just brings the person, because the things that are, it's cufflinks and paperbacks, and you can pound the dent out on the hood, and it's just concrete. And maybe it's just because the subject is something that we don't really want to deal with in the concrete. We want to think of, we want to think body counts, we want to think the politics of war, we want to think just war theory, we want to think, but then all of a sudden you hear this list of all the possessions of a single person.
It's that, maybe that a little bit, that's a very, very powerful subject matter, but maybe that's a little bit of the yellow wings, the specific, that the parts of the personality that come out because the microscope comes in so close.
I think it's also when people hear songs, like when I just heard that song, Sanger, I've never heard that song you're just talking about, but it's going to register with people, and then they're going to interpret it, what it means to them, because someone who's lonely, like, you know, I could picture the bird being a friend to someone who you're looking for a friend. It's kind of someone who's not going to harm you. You can kind of be vulnerable. It's kind of safe, right. You know, but they're being kind of companions to each other.
Yeah.
And that's why, but then, yeah, someone who lost somebody in the war or something, either could be bitter by that song or it could be comforting to them.
Yeah, a memory of someone, yeah.
Peter, it may help to give that conversation some context. One of the villagers that brought that to the first session I had led was a surgeon who is up here on sabbatical. And she talked about her writing has been so starkly descriptive forever. Patient complains of abdominal pain. And so was your writing session and yearning for getting past that or through that. And did. Wrote about a bus trip that her whole extended family had taken back to Slovakia to meet first cousins and relatives, and was very descriptive, but clearly was able to bring lots of heart and feeling and reflection to it as well. But that was somewhere where it came from somebody who said, I've got these facts, I deal in a world of facts. Mm-hmm.
That really is helpful in knowing, because at first, when you said that, I literally had trouble separating the two. It was right. Like, wait a minute, isn't it just writing? You know, I think it hints too toward a relationship. There's always someone you're talking to, or there's always a dialogue, or there's always a listener, even when you're writing alone. I wonder if we could write in a true vacuum, even if it's yourself at a different time and place. You know, even if it's a more primal or earlier self that you're writing to, there seems to always be a dialogue. Does it strike anybody else that way? Like that we need, or even if it's good Lord above, I mean, or the spirit, it's like somehow there is a canyon to echo or something with which to resonate.
I think in songs there's like a desire to be heard. Mm-hmm. So whether it's, you know, yourself or someone else trying to understand you, mm-hmm. then it's that you want to get the word out somehow.
Mm-hmm. Well, sound doesn't exist in a vacuum. You know, it needs something to bounce off of.
Yeah. I'd like to, if I could, just, I found some interesting quotes of some that we talked about last time, last June when I was here. But things that kind of piqued my interest and kind of irritated me in some ways, and I'd just like to hear from you, if I could, what you think of these thoughts about, this is about writing, and you could say it's about journaling, maybe it's even about songwriting. By the way, how many in here play an instrument and have written a song? How many are journaling? So we have songwriters, raise your hand. Okay, and who is journaling now? Is everybody involved in that? Can I read you these? And please feel free to jump in. The first one is from William Stafford. He's one of my favorite poets. He was known to say at one point, when asked how he could produce so many worthy works and just this copious library of poems, he said, well, I've lowered my standards enough to produce these. He has a wonderful grasp on the process of writing, and I really treasure what he's given to writers' understandings. This is what he said: we need to write poems that won't last forever. Anybody, just off the cuff, if you have a response to that. I thought that was interesting when I first read it. Shouldn't every poem last forever? Shouldn't you write for the ages?
Well, if you thought you were writing for the ages, you would. I mean, if I thought I was writing for the ages, I wouldn't write anything. You know? So, I mean, it would right away be a wall if you're not willing to just write something that you can throw away.
Well, I mean, there's a context, isn't there? I mean, a context of time or place or perhaps, and that context changes.
Mm-hmm. That's what I thought. It was always the kind of a different season that you're writing and write about, and then it would be really, I mean, you wouldn't want to write if you knew that nothing would ever change. It would be so miserable to think that what you're writing about, if it's something about the world or your own personal life, and this is set in stone, this is how it's always going to be, then it would be just like writing your own death or something. Mm.
But isn't that part of, I'll just ask kind of whether this is rhetorical or the devil's advocate, I don't know, but isn't that part of our desire to write is to somehow touch the timeless, somehow rise above, or maybe it's just to grumble and growl for a minute, and that's definitely part of journaling. And but isn't it in a sense, you know, to reach, if not timelessness, some kind of transcendence?
But I think it has less to do with time and more, or less to do with place and time and more to do with a person's interpretation of it. People, no matter, you know, in different walks of life, people will read a poem or listen to a song in a different way. And so you wouldn't want something, you can't have something that lasts forever in the same way, because no one will ever see it in the same way.
I like that. I mean, in that it always is of greater or less importance to different people. And like what you said, Ralph, if we're always intending for the prize, or we're always intending for this grand destination, we just lose most of the journey in the process, it seems.
I think sometimes though the songs that are most powerful for me. I mean, you can hear a song that you really like, and a year later you never listen to it again. But there's other songs that are sort of timeless, but they're not necessarily because of the subject matter, but it's maybe it's because of, again, how I said, I think, how you internally respond to that. I mean, in fact, something deep inside you that is going to probably, very likely be there. There are songs that I'll respond to, have responded for the last 20 years,
yeah.
Very similar, in very similar ways. No matter how many times I hear them, they somehow touch something in me that I don't necessarily think they were written to be, you know, with a purpose of being a timeless song, but you know, they achieve that point, at least for
yeah.
me.
Yeah. And one thing that William Stafford would speak to that is that out of hundreds of those songs that ended up in a drawer, that one was one written without a care or for the moment that had its time, that rose. But it didn't rise because he really tried to make that
right.
good. It rose because he gave it the opportunity of engagement every day. Or that, you know, he calls it lucky talk as well. Like, you know, when your words have just found others that at work.
Well, and I think there may be an irony in that some of the things that are timeless in fact capture that moment.
Mm-hmm.
So really are steeped in specificity and the present, and maybe unintentionally get
mm-hmm.
further. You think of St. Paul's letters.
Yeah.
That are written to very particular congregations in very particular circumstances, are not even congruent with each other entirely, which drives interpreters crazy, but that particularity gets closer
yeah.
to universal than for Canterbury Tales.
Yeah. Does that also get them in trouble with the changes in social mores and...
Oh, sure, it keeps it interesting.
Yeah. That was a good answer. You just avoided a two-hour talk there.
Yeah, but in those lines, too, I keep thinking of hymnody, which are poems, such music, you know,
sure.
and they're in, they come in... You know, we all have different hymns we like or don't like. And I know as a parish pastor, people would say, well, let's sing the old favorites. I say, you give me your list, I'll give you mine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. And because we all respond to them
yeah.
Differently. But you think when you're talking about, you know, something done in specificity, it becomes timeless. Like, you think of Silent Night.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, which was very specific and then is, you know, just... deeply
yeah.
loved, and there are others that everybody just goes like, why did they ever write that, you know?
St. Patrick's breast.
Yeah.
Maybe speaking to the motive, too, like, don't try to write things that are going to be timeless, because you'll be disappointed. But it's that thing that naturally some things are going to end up being timeless.
I think he's largely speaking to the motive or process, if you want to say. He's largely speaking to what makes a writer. A writer writes. A writer doesn't have success, win awards, and go live out in the hog, or although that happens to writers. A writer writes. That's the process.
Well, and you think about all the art that's not recognized in
time. Oh.
And then generations later, it's uncovered. And
yeah.
Well, Bach's St. Matthew Passion, for example.
Pardon?
Bach's St. Matthew Passion,
yeah.
for example.
Well, just tons of things.
Yeah.
Here's another one. Appealing workplaces are to be avoided. One wants a room with no view, so imagination can meet memory in the dark. That's Annie Dillard.
Mm.
What do you think of that?
Yeah,
well, this room
comes to
mind. I think we picked the right one.
Why don't we all memorize that for 10 o'clock?
That's 10 o'clock today.
Yeah.
Creativity
today.
Yeah.
Appealing workplaces.
Everybody's going to want to write things down.
I think she's pointing to how she likes to work. Appealing workplaces are to be avoided. One wants a room with no view, so imagination can meet memory in the dark.
Mm-hmm. But I think to understand that quote, you'd have to read a lot of her stuff. To understand the kind
of... Well, what if you took it just as a writer? Like, we want you to write in a room with no windows. And, or what do you think it's saying? What do you think it's saying to you? One wants a room with no view, so imagination can meet memory in the dark.
Well, the view can be distracting.
And maybe she's speaking to a distraction. I love how she captures the memory, though, that we're always remembering part of a greater whole or something that we've been given from the start, or part of our relationship, part of our connections.
I think it sounds good, but I don't know if it's really, I don't know. I mean, that would be a universal kind of a thing. Because I think we also have there are, our eyes sometimes maybe trigger things, or even if they're not really focusing on what we're looking at, it's very hard to be in the dark.
For me, what I think she's talking, I mean, it seems from the, at least from the obvious, it's she's talking about a you know, a physical room. But sometimes the most powerful things that I read or listen to seem to be coming from the darkness. For the person who writes them is a period of maybe darkness in their lives, or I mean, they're not coming from a place where everything's beautiful. Mm. They're coming from a place where they're sort of lost.
I like that attachment to mystery, because I don't think it's at least in my case, I don't think it's always darkness, because sometimes it's absolute awe, but it seems to come from an almost scary, dark, mysterious place, that the unknowable that becomes somehow more known through writing. There's one more here. There's something humbling in the presence of the arts. There is no use thinking hard work and application and responsibility will capture poetry. It is something different. It can't live in the atmosphere of competition, politics, business, and advertising. Successful people cannot find poems, for you must kneel down and explore for them. They seep into the world all the time and lodge in odd corners almost anywhere in your talk, in the conversation around you. They can be terribly irresponsible. He says the poems cannot live in the atmosphere of competition, politics, business, advertising. Successful people cannot find poems. This one kind of irritated me.
Yeah. Who says this?
This is William Stafford again. He is almost militaristically anti hands-on teaching. He's very, very strict about keeping your hands off a work of art. And no outside influence, as in writing for a hit song or something. I think it applies specifically to his poetry, but this irritates me because I've seen professionals I've worked with and for operate real successfully in this realm, you know, of politics and competition. But there's a part of me that also agrees with him, because I think that something of this, the seedling is whisked away when you throw it into the marketplace too early. It's I think sometimes it can really be tainted, and I see it a lot in Nashville, where people bring in songs and you just get real pat lines one after another, and I think I personally get tired of that.
What does he mean, successful people can't find poems?
Yeah, what do you think that means? Do you agree with that? Do you not?
I don't know what he's trying to say.
I think he's saying that position and a certain amount of status cannot give you a good poem.
But a good poem can give you some position and status. Mm-hmm. You know, when the I Have a Dream speech, we heard it because there had been great speeches before that, and then that was a great speech by a successful political socially astute person, that with an ego, you know, it wasn't. I mean, and to me, that was a piece of art.
Yeah,
a beautiful art.
I think
you said that was a piece of art. That wasn't.
Yeah.
I think certain artwork by unsuccessful people can be overlooked because of artwork by successful people. Like, I'm in this art history class, and we're talking about the Renaissance era and these great artists that came out of it. And we were talking about the piece of art, the Mona Lisa, which I think it's been more hyped up than, I mean, I understand that for its time it's a beautiful piece, but I've seen so much other artwork that I think is tons more beautiful. And I think people associate, partly because you're so used to it, you know, people can relate to it because they know it. So sometimes if you're so blinded by the success of it, you can't really look at it.
in my songwriting life, this has really been a painful source for me, because you really do get into a competitive thing about trying to get songs on albums and that kind of thing. And it really has taken me a lot of work to try to get into a safe, childlike state again, to write like that. And there's nothing wrong with writing with an intent in mind. I really believe that. Or a certain end, like writing for Jimmy Buffett or writing for certain artists. But it's very difficult when I perceive it's happening more in kind of a machine state, which sometimes in Nashville it can take on that character.
India's comment took me back to something I read recently about Van Gogh, who was in an asylum by the end of his life. And I think they were given something like 20 minutes a day outdoors. And he then went back into the dark room. It took me back to the other quote. Mm-hmm. And he painted Starry Night.
Oh, my God. Mm-hmm. That's wild.
Yeah.
Well, there's certainly an inner seeing in there. Here are just a few affirmation quotes that have meant a lot to me in my writing, and I hope they can inform and inspire you as well and offer you some freedom. A poet is not so much someone who has something to say as someone who has found a process that will bring him out new things he would have not thought of if he had not started to say them. That's William Stafford just believing again and again that one word follows another. There's no other criteria but that one word follows another. By the end of the poem, what is claimed is not much, but it is undeniable. And something like choosing a color, let me see if I can get this grammatic right. By the end of the poem, what is claimed is not much, but it is undeniable. And something like choosing a color one likes become, oh, something like choosing a color one likes becomes like a banner for the life force. Writing takes a lot of forgiveness, freedom, and welcoming. You should welcome the impulses that come to you. Don't try to stiff arm your feeble little thoughts. They are all you have. in this one by Andy Dillard, is, you can't test courage cautiously. I like that one. It's kind of throwing yourself into the deep water. This is one thing that I kind of use as a mantra. This is what I hold close when I write, and especially when I feel worthless. This helps me a lot. It's not worthless in the sense of not having any worth as a human being, but as an artist, when I feel at a low point, it is impossible to write something that does not move us forward as a community when this now is greeted with the best of us and has regard for the rest of us. It helps me to know that anything is possible when you begin, and you greet the beginning with the best of you. And of course, in the tradition I was raised, the best of me is what God has made me of. If you are penning the pilgrimage, bringing your life to language, you are expected to share it, give it in some way, or else you brought nothing. So to me, there's just this natural dialogue there. If you're bringing your life to language, you're bringing life to language. There's a listener implied there. As a songwriter, I assume the same kind of dialogue. There's always a listener that is given. Even a simple description of a scene is made to elicit a response from the listener. Not an agreement or disagreement, but an engagement for whatever that brings. What I had hoped to do, and I got together with both Carissa and Liz, they came after the session last time and gave me poems that Carissa had written one, and Liz had one that she really, really has been an inspiration and leading in her life. And we experimented a little bit with putting tunes and making a song out of it. So I'd like to ask you, Carissa, first to, we're going to kind of play the fool here and just experiment a little bit and see what we come up with, if that's all right with you. Can you give us an idea of what you brought in, and do you want to read it to all, or
mean the full, the length of it?
What Carissa brought in was a full poem that we distilled down to a slightly shorter version. It wasn't made to be ultimate value or judgment on this, it was more just for workability. Do you want to start by telling them what you wrote and basically how that came about?
So I wrote this, it was kind of like a song in my head called Love Again, and I had written a poem for my mother-in-law called Hospitality of the Heart, just how people show hospitality differently. And it was on the computer and just kind of came out of me. And so I'd never written a song before, but it's kind of like a song poem. And so I didn't have any music before, I kind of had a melody to it. And then when Peter had mentioned that, I was like, oh, it'd be so cool to see if it could be a song.
Yeah.
So do you want me to read this one or just read that one?
Why don't you read what you originally wrote? I think that would be nice to have that.
And the kind of context is, I'm married, I have a husband, I love God. But you know you love somebody and you want to be loved, but at the same time, you realize that you're still scared to love and you're still scared to be vulnerable. And you just kind of feel that tension, at least me, I kind of feel that tension in me sometimes. Like, am I really loving? Am I really allowing people to love me? Or am I still scared? Am I still holding back? In that battle within that I don't want to keep being scared, I don't want to keep holding back, I really want to love and be loved. So, will you love me when I'm broken? Love me when I fall? I will never be perfect. Can you handle me at all? I'm afraid to let my heart out of the box I've held it in. If I let you love me, where will you begin? Because I'm scared, scared of being in love. Yes, I'm scared, been hurt way too much. I'm dying inside, sometimes it feels that way. My heart feels so empty, will it always be this way? I want to let you love me, I want to love you too. But I'm scared of loving you. Yes, I'm scared, show me what to do. What does it feel like to let your heart be free? What does it feel like to love so eagerly? I want to feel that feeling, I want to be free. Teach me how to love again, for pain has captured me. But I'm scared of loving you. Yes, I'm scared to let love break through. You say I've got to trust some time, or I will never know. You say to test the waters, or I will never grow. I know I want to love again, I know I want to see. My heart filled with love, and someone loving me. But I'm scared of loving you. Yes, I'm scared, I don't know what to do. My heart is lonely, it wants to be free. My heart is aching to be loved tenderly. I don't always want to feel this way. I don't always want to fear. Help me to love again. I know I need you here. But I'm scared to be free. Yes, I'm scared to let you love me. I want you to love me. I want to love you back. I'm trying to be brave. Your love makes up for my lack. But I'm scared of being loved. Yes, I'm scared. Can your love be enough? Are you scared? Are you scared of loving me? You should be scared. I hurt so easily. Will you promise to be gentle? Will you promise to be kind? Will you promise to remind me that loving is just fine? I want to give my heart to you. I want to know your love. I want to be close to you. Is trying enough? I won't be scared. I'll give my heart to you. Hold my hand. I know you love me too. I'm not scared.
Thanks, Carissa. So Carissa and I got together and I was, first of all, really impressed that you put your heart out there and you know, got the way you feel, got your heart, got your emotions out on paper, which I think is wonderful. And it sounded in rhythm so much like a song, verse chorus set up, that I wondered if there was a melody, and only to find out there was. You had thought about a melody when you wrote it, and so I asked her what that was. And we did a little co-write together. And in this key, can you sing just a little bit of melody, and I'll take all of it. I can try to get it. I'm just afraid I'm going to screw up your melody. Just sing, no key, just the first line, and just to make sure I got it.
Will you love me when I'm broken? Love me when I fall?
Yeah, good. Yeah, that's basically it. So I did an A just for my own convenience.
Will you love me when I'm broken? Love me when I fall? I will never...
That's what first occurred to me. So as a co-writer, what's first going through my head is her rhythmic feel. What will honor her words the very best? And we can kind of look now for what works with that and try it in several different situations. But the way you sang it, Carissa, sounds so much like... Phrasing. The process I go through personally, and maybe the other musicians here, maybe you've done this, but I just experiment around and let other thoughts come in and destroy that little playground and put something in. And maybe, like, it's interesting, it's almost set up like a 12-bar blues, and not exactly, but...
Will love me when I'm broken, love me when I fall. I will never be perfect. Can you handle me at all? I'm afraid to let my heart out of the box I held it in. If I let you love me, where will you begin?
Something like that. It gets a different, a little bit angular. It's weird. It almost makes me happier. But it still sounds like someone's been wronged, or you can tell you're just on the edge. Chris and I were kind of having some fun too. Like a
hey, Mom.
Yeah.
Will you love me when I'm broken? Love me when I fall? I will never be perfect. Can you handle me at all? I'm afraid to let my heart out. Well, in this box I've held it in.
Whoops.
If you let me love you, where will we begin? Oh, cause I'm scared. Or scared to be in love. Yes, I'm scared. Gonna hurt me way too much.
That's like a reggae. Just fun to see where it could come from. It's such a deep emotional approach, though, Carissa. I almost thought if you really...
When I'm broken, love me when I fall. I'm afraid to let my heart out of the box I built it in. If I let you love me, where would you be then? Cause I'm scared of being in love.
It's kind of real. That's just an example. How do those hit you? What do you like? What do you not? Do you have any other ideas for speed metal? Or Santana. I mean, you know, you just try things. You need a vocabulary to do this, but that's out of that process. I usually glean what makes the words spark.
So my question is, then when you've done that, how do you know which is truest to the words? Do you just sense it, or? Do you hear a different piece of the truth in each one of those?
Well, does anybody want to answer that? Rolf, you're a songwriter.
I think you get a sense of what's really, you know, if you've written the words and the tune, you kind of know when you're not really, when the tune isn't telling the truth.
And how do you know? I mean, do you, you just have that feeling, you have, or lack of a feeling?
I guess it's easier for me when it's a song of feeling.
Mm-hmm.
What, you know, if it's a song of social commentary, you can put it in a lot of different forms, it seems like. And but, or a biblical text,
mm-hmm.
you know, there are,
yeah.
there's some that seem to really just speak it,
yeah.
And some that just seem like, oh, this melody fits this. I mean, you've seen them because there are a lot, most hymn texts aren't written to the tunes we sing them to. And so you'll see the same, what's that? There's a wideness in God's mercy that Tom's played so much. There's a new version,
mm.
not new probably, but it's one that, you know, I remember singing it a certain way, a couple different ways, and then I heard this version, I thought, there's no way the congregation can sing this song.
Mm.
Just, this is just not, it's beautiful, but it's just not gonna work.
Interesting.
And, but we sang it three or four different times, and it's like the words were carried so well on that melody. Once you knew it, it's just like, I don't think I could go back.
There is a point where, is that the tipping point where it just proves its case with more, you know, more proof than you can count. At, you know, it's just sometimes somehow makes it case. Can I ask you a question in return, Paul?
Yeah.
When you wrote, I don't know if your book is done yet, you're in the process, but the things you finished, the paper you wrote on your junk man dad, when did you know that was done?
Yeah, I haven't gone back to that for a while. That's a really good question. I think there's a difference between the things I write for myself and the stuff I write for work.
Mm.
Part of the stuff I write for work. And my mantra for the thing I'm writing now is, there are perfect dissertations and there are finished ones.
That's good. Yeah, it's true.
When you were playing those pieces, I mean, I've never really heard that before, with taking, you know, all those different styles for one. And there was a couple that I didn't particularly like so well, but there was lots of them I did like. There was two or three that I liked equally well, at least
mm-hmm.
in the first hearing. And it'd be interesting to, have you ever done one of your own songs in a concert,
mm-hmm.
two or three different ways with the same, in the same
Not movie? In a concert, no. We did it on an album once, did two versions,
mm-hmm.
but.
You did?
Yeah, it was a song called Intuition. We'd kind of turned it into an Asian, Indian kind of beat, but it was by the behest of someone, Stuart Copeland actually, the manager of the Police, that wanted us to change our image and be wild Asian people with beads on and stuff. I mean, it was really a crazy time, but
mm-hmm.
he was thinking about signing us and he wanted us to have a look. And we were at a point in our life when we would do almost anything to be signed, including be wild Asian people with beads on. You know? It sounds funny, but it was true. We took photos for it and everything. But I like both versions, and you know, Paul, in answer to your question, the one that I gravitate to is usually the one that I just have a core feeling, and I want to go on playing it, and it somehow buys me time and gives me transcendence, and out of those, I almost... I almost feel the emptiness and the openness when I played it, but I also like this steady, you know, it could almost be a happy song about a nice afternoon, but you're talking about, but I'm attracted very much to harmony and how it's set up. So.
I don't know how many people go right in the way of, I'll lay out five melodies and see which one I like best.
Yeah.
So I think it's,
yeah.
you know what I mean? Like, I think the way to find the true, you know, quote-unquote, truest melody is one that sort of comes to you in the first place.
Right.
Well, I don't want to be a fly on the island, but I'm dying to know if Carissa and you like the same one.
Yeah, Carissa, what, or have we not found it yet?
No, there's some that are like, yeah, fun, but like, to truly match, like, kind of for me, the vulnerability
yeah.
of the words, it's like the kind of slow, kind of drawn out one. But I was telling them when we were talking, I think it's how whoever sings it, like, if I were to sing my own song, I'd do the slow, drawn one. But if
mm-hmm.
you'd be singing this song from, like, a male perspective, it would probably be up a little more because men are going to be so vulnerable, like, because I'm scared. They're going to be like,
oh, yeah,
a little more, you know? Mm-hmm. Might be a little more like country style or something. But
yeah, it was interesting. She exactly. She mentioned that it would actually sound more manly to be a country song.
Maybe. Or just something with a little more, because women can kind of be vulnerable in the silence and speak their words of truth. Maybe a man kind of need a little background noise when they're doing that.
And I'll tell Indy, you had a really good point. Not everyone goes to five different versions. Why would you? I'll tell you why I do it, and not on every song, because some singing in your cage was the first time played it out, it was done. And I worked out the guitar parts, of course, but other songs, I don't feel it yet, but I believe in the lyric. There's one that I wanted to run by you guys, and tell me when time is getting weird, because we need to go over your song list. But I want to give you a line and see if you would follow, if you have any thoughts to follow it. I'll just give you a line. This doesn't need to be done tonight or anything like that. But can I just throw out a line that really has buzzed me lately that I know it's a lyric for a song?
Oh, you wonder if we have lyrics to follow?
I'm just wondering if thoughts come to you. You can journal on it, you can write a following line. And I've written some following lines, but I don't want to tell you what they are. I'm just really interested in what you guys see in this. But I love this. It's out of Love Poems from God. And this was St. Teresa of Avila. Is that right, Paul?
Avila.
Avila, thank you. She says, God's will for a wing. Every bird knows that. God's will for a wing. Every bird knows that. Now, can I follow with my line? That this is the way I stated it. And you can use either. So Teresa's Avila is every God's will for a wing. Every bird knows that. I changed that to every bird knows God's will for a wing.
Did Teresa write more than that? Or?
Yeah, I'm really sorry. I forgot the book, and I had written this down in my notes. There's a poem to precede that, so this book might even be in the bookstore here. And I may be able to find it online if the internet will. But I would be happy to. But Paul, this in response to you, the reason I singled out this phrase is because often I will see something shiny, and it will just spark out of a poem. And this phrase really, really struck me. So if you would just, I guess we have to at some point we can either reconvene or, but I'm just curious what your thought may be to follow that.
Can you just say your line one more time? How did you change
my it? My line was, every bird knows God's will for a wing. And Teresa's was, God's will for a wing, every bird knows that.
Do you have a way you're going to sing that first line?
Yeah. No, not really. I've got an idea, but again, it's kind of an idea that I immediately go to, and you know, you have ruts and grooves you get into, and I like to force myself out of those, so I may just set up five or six of them and see what I like. And that's really the only way I've stumbled on new stuff is when I force myself to not do old stuff.
You're
so
prolific, I would think that would be hard.
Well, no, you're going to repeat yourself. It's good to repeat yourself because you have sounds and everything. But to me, I have a short attention span and I really like to be interested. And if I'm not interested in the songs I'm singing, I don't think I can expect anybody else to be at some point. Mm-hmm.
But why don't we take a look at your song?
Well, maybe what we can do is at some other time we can quickly pull out and just see what people come up with, or if anybody has any ideas. I want to make sure to get your trick. Liz brought in this beautiful poem that I believe you shared with the village.
Yeah, some people heard it last week. Anybody that came more recently probably hasn't heard it, but that's the Tourist and the Pilgrim, the short piece of paper. A poem by Macrina Whitaker.
We got together and Liz, can you first tell us what draws you to this, what drew you to this poem? You love
this
poem.
Well, I was given this poem at the beginning part of a 9-month prayer program that I just started called SEAL, Spiritual Exercises for Everyday Life. And at kind of the opening day that the whole group of participants were together, they gave us, someone read it, and then they gave us all a copy when we left. And so it's just kind of about the trying to find yourself, trying to find what is the path that you're trying to follow home, listening to the truth deep within, that the truth is there. But and that what struck me was when I knew that Paul's Pilgrim program was going on, and when I got this poem, I thought, oh, I'll have to take this up to Holden, and I figured he probably had already seen it, but found that it was new to him as well, so it's been fun to tie it into Paul's Pilgrim talks as well.
When Liz brought it in, we talked about how we could approach it, because she loved the whole thing in its entirety, and I found it hard to, without being through composed and spending a lot of time, it can easily, no, not easily be done, but it can be done, where you just orchestrate and you follow through and tell a story, and because it's told in kind of a prose-like way, it's a prose poem. Mm-hmm. But we decided for the short term to pick out highlights and meaning where Liz saw real bright spots, and we went ahead and called it Holy Ground of Home, and started throwing lines back and forth. We went first to the phrase, there is a road that runs straight through the heart. And we decided that was such a central part of that we were going to make that a chorus beginning. So I'll play you what we kind of ended up with. Where is the place last, when will I be saved and where? My tormented heart is wearing me out. My bags are full of temporary cares. For there is a road that runs straight through the heart. Wait a minute, is the melody? There is a road that runs straight through the heart. Holy ground of home. Stand on the edge of myself and all I know. There is a road. Walk on, walk on. Oh, there is a road. Walk on. The table is set, but you will not eat. Not satisfied with what you get. There's truth all around you, but your blindness is deep. You've not loved the pilgrim in you yet. Okay, and then the chorus, right?
Yeah.
And there is a road that runs straight through the heart, moving toward the holy ground of home. I stand on the edge of myself and all I know. There is a road, walk on, walk on. Oh, there is a road, walk on. Do you remember the bridge?
I just thought it was different. No, I don't specifically.
Yeah.
Gentles me, gentles.
That's right.
And the voice from within rises up and gentles me, gentles me. And the voice
from within. Let's see, the voice. We didn't have the second half finished, but had considered.
And the voice from within rises up, says, follow me.
So unfinished as of today, but it was a way of distilling the high points of what we saw in the poem into singable, and I really, really like the chorus.
Yeah. Yeah.
You should finish a song. It's a good song.
So it's a work in progress, and we'll continue to. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We gotta split. But we'll continue on this, and maybe before we have to leave on Sunday, we'll have it completed.
Yeah.
Complete work.